Good morning. It's Paul. It's Monday. Oh, what is it? It must be the 4th. October 4th. And it's 7:59 or so a.m., which means that I successfully dropped the kids off early. 2 minutes early. The doors had not been closed and the people were still going in and the bells hadn't rung. And it was good. I got them up earlier this morning. They were still putzing around and doing their frustrating thing of spending 10 minutes staring into space rather than eating their... There's the bell. I don't know if you can hear that. Rather than eating their breakfast. So, it's a big weekend. Busy, crazy weekend. It's sort of our holiday season because we have birthday parties in October. We have, Grace and I have our anniversary. We would have gone out or something. I spent our 12th wedding anniversary. I spent the entire day in the bathroom with vomiting and diarrhea. It was great. Grace came in and said, while I'm throwing up, she said, so, you know, it's our anniversary. I just wanted to say happy anniversary. Thanks. Anyway, so we ate badly all weekend, or should I say really, really celebratorily, in a celebratory fashion, and kind of paying for it. I'm all stuffed up. Sam is all stuffed up. He had some kind of a mild virus on Halloween, was throwing tantrums, and he didn't get to go out. So quick review. So Halloween, it actually rained all day, Halloween day, all day and into the evening, straight through trick-or-treating. So, lightly, and by evening. So our turnout was somewhat reduced, but we still probably had, it's hard to estimate exactly, based on the amount of candy we gave out, which is not precise because I'm pulling out these little suckers and throwing them in bags, and sometimes I'm trying to calibrate it so we give them all away, but some kids get one, some kids get two, and then I'm thinking, okay, if it's really slowing down, I want to use them up. But my guess is 500 kids, which is lower than it has been. I have some jokes I want to make about Halloween costumes and social commentary, but I think it's too long a form to include here. And it will just come off as sounding like a racist joke or something, but I want to work it into a stand-up commentary routine kind of thing, basically. But the short form is that I briefly thought that I was briefly very moved and touched by the number of kids who were turning out dressed in homage to the late Trayvon Martin. And after a while, I realized that they weren't actually. Anyway, we have so many kids who are high school kids. You know, when you're handing Halloween candy to a kid in a hoodie who's taller than you and has a bigger mustache than you've got, that, you know, this isn't quite the Halloween that maybe you expected. I never looked anyone, I mean, there are a few adults too, and I never looked at them and said, aren't you a little old to be trick-or-treating? Which is what I'm thinking. You don't know if they're taking home candy for their younger brother or something like that, I guess. So I assume a good intent, but I am a little sick of the teenagers without costumes coming around. Trick or treat, thank you. I have a topic. Woohoo. Anyway, so Halloween evening was odd too. We had a night of very high winds, and it was predicted. Wonderground.com said it was going to happen, and it happened. So we had an evening of high winds, and they were predicting, I think, a lot of downed trees and whatnot. So I was ready for the likely power outage. Fortunately, it wasn't cold. The house wouldn't have gotten very cold. But the power stayed on. We did have high winds all evening. And I did a podcast Friday morning, and we still had major wind gusts. I have recorded a couple of walks, and wound up basically deleting them as being too rambling. So this is actually, if you're listening to this one, it's actually because I picked it out as being less rambling than the others, if you can believe it. So you can only imagine what the rambling one sounded like. Anyway, Saturday was baby Benjamin's baptism. And it's the weirdest thing. It was about 5 weeks ago that I wrote out Benjamin Mary, M-E-R-R-Y, Potts on a form. And we had this tiny baby. And 5 weeks later, I'm looking up at the screen at church, and there's this big message on the PowerPoint. It said, spelling out his name, said, "Please welcome our candidate for baptism, Benjamin Mary Potts." And I'm like, wow. So I just wrote that down, and now it's like, that's his name. It's real. It's still, having done it five times, I didn't name Isaac, but having done it five times, it still weirds me out that it's like this art project become real. He's making it kind of ironic because he's not very merry. I think he planned that. He is one cranky little hot water bottle with big eyes, big saucer eyes. He's in good health though. We had him checked out with a follow-up appointment, and his cord stump's fallen off, and he's gaining weight very rapidly. He's up to, he was almost 10 pounds a few days ago, so he's probably quite a bit, he's actually probably 11 pounds by now. So he's almost doubled his birth weight after a month, which is good progress. I think Veronica was the fastest gaining one, but he's doing well. So we had a big dinner to celebrate, and we had a cake that was made for us by the Patisserie Bakery here in Saginaw. I know patisserie means bakery, but it's the name of their store. So I should just call it the Patisserie, but then I sound like I'm being pompous. Le Patisserie. So baby Benjamin's godparents came out with their kids. They have five kids too. So the church and then our home was rocking. It was overrun with kids, and it was both fun and exhausting. Fun because, you know, we have this big house, and we always imagined that we would be doing things in it, that it would be busy, we'd fill up that space. And I think with 10 kids, we were finally, there's still more space, you know, to play. So, but I think that 10 kids would just about make us feel fully justified in the amount of space we have. We're too old to have 4 more kids, and certainly not 5 more young kids. But we do. We have this ongoing thing where we want to do, like, homeschooling with other parents. We want to make it like a Montessori school. I want to have meetings and classes and electronics and programming and English and all kinds of things we want to do. And there's space. It's just not, we can't keep it organized. We can't stay on top of it. We haven't even finished unpacking. So many rooms just have piles of stuff. And Grace isn't very good at it. And I don't have time for it. Not working full time and then trying to take on everything else that I do and fit a little time in for hobbies and reading. So, speaking of reading, I have a topic. My topic today is, what are you reading? I would invite comments from listeners just like you. This will be on a blog. There is a comment section. Comments are moderated. I will approve almost all comments if they don't involve Viagra and Cialis or counterfeit handbags. Hey, someone has a treadmill for sale, $75, sitting in their front yard. I've kind of wanted to have a treadmill desk. I'll have to think on that. The thing is, a cheap treadmill is really, like, a bad treadmill is really bad. Flimsy treadmills are really crappy. But the ones you kind of want, the ones you would use at the gym, they're incredibly expensive, and they're heavy. Like, you would need a team of... They're hard to grip, hard to hold on to. I've moved them. You'd need a team of burly men to help get it up into my office. And it's not nearly organized enough to have space for something like that now. It looked like a flimsy one. I'm not sure I want it. Also, we just don't have extra money to spend right now. So what are you reading? I'm going to run through some of the books that I've been reading over the past year. This isn't a comprehensive list. I don't actually keep a comprehensive list, unfortunately. Things get really disorganized. My books are... Their behavior is kind of sketchy. They do a lot of line jumping and hiding, and I think they fight. So, like, I've been looking for the next book in this one series I've been reading, and I had it in hardcover that I got at the discount books, and I can't find it. I think it left somewhere. It would make sense for me to have, like, a single to-read pile. But that pile, when I've tried to do that, that pile is so big that it, like, covers a tabletop to the point where the books are falling off the piles. So I tried to put them on a shelf or in a cabinet, but they resist that kind of treatment. And then there are line jumpers, books that, like, take this opportunistic moment to get in my face and demand to be read first and tell everyone else to, you'll just have to wait. And I'm just not, I don't impose enough discipline on them, really. So they get away with a lot of crap. Anyway, here's some of what I read this past year. From what I could glean by looking at my shelves and piles of books that are put away or in boxes or half put away or not organized because I don't have enough shelves and all that. Alastair Reynolds. He's one of my favorite science fiction writers, a British science fiction writer. He wrote a book called Chasm City and a whole bunch of related books, and also writes fantastic short stories in sort of a dark space opera, new space opera vein. Really good stuff. He wrote a book called Doctor Who, Harvest of Time, which, as you might guess, is a Doctor Who story. But it's not an adaptation of an existing show. It's an original story, and it involves the third Doctor, John Pertwee, plays him, that incarnation of the Doctor with the white hair and the judo moves, the cape, the one who's stuck on Earth because his TARDIS is disabled. He fights the Master, and the thing that's amazing about this book, I mean, really, it's one of these, I don't even know what you call them, adaptations, novels, series novels, you know, spin-off novels, I guess. It's a spin-off novel from a franchise, and I usually don't have a lot of respect for those, but every once in a while I find one that's really good, and sometimes when they tap a talented author, manages to come up with a really good story. So it's quite funny. It's quite good. What's amazing about it, though, is the way that it manages to capture the tone of the show, as in the dialogue, the tone of the dialogue, the snappiness of the dialogue. Even you can see in your head the low-budget sets. It's part of it set on an oil rig, and you can just see like this, like they would always have to use practical sets, like electrical generating stations and quarries and places like that, that aren't really dressed very well. They're not really convincingly alien ships or anything. So it just has that feel, completely has that feel of cheesiness, and describes vortexes and time and space and whatnot, and the way you see them in your mind's eye, just hinted at by the writing very cleverly. The effects are cheesy and low budget, and I just found that really funny and fascinating. And it has a great plot twist, which if you're an astute reader, you can kind of see coming to some extent, and there's some plot twists maybe you can't see coming, and so he did a great job with it. Alastair Reynolds, Doctor Who, Harvest of Time. It's not really much like Alastair Reynolds' dark space opera, but really enjoyed it. Jules Sherrod had posted about this book, and she was giving away copies. And that induced me to go get one and read it. Leon Hearn, Tales of the Otori. I picked this up in the wrong order because I picked up a book at a discount book warehouse called The Harsh Cry of the Heron, the first tale of the Otori. But actually it was published last, which is confusing. So it's like the most recent book, and it looked like I was starting a series, and I wasn't. It's sort of a prequel. But it didn't make that much sense to me until I found, so I went back and found a 6-volume set of the early trilogy in these little manga volumes from Firebird Books. Like, each novel is in two parts, in two volumes, and they're small, quick to read. It's set in a fantasy world that's like similar to or inspired by feudal Japan. And if that sounds boring already, then I won't try and convince you. But it's a beautiful story. It's beautifully written. The main character is very appealing. An orphan, you know, taken away from his home by war, who has to find his destiny, and, you know, it's like... But it's not... it avoids a lot of cliches. Not completely. You know, there's a love interest and warlords and scheming brothers and jockeying for power. But it's beautifully written. Books of essays. Got piles of books of essays. You can often find books of essays and books of short stories at these discount bookstores in abundance, more so than novels. I'm not quite sure why. I really have come to like the form of essays and short stories, partly because I don't have extended chunks of my day to read. I might get 20 minutes in the morning or 30 minutes, and so an essay or a short story is perfect. It's one of the reasons I read the New York Review of Books. The various books of essays by the pair of Jonathans, Jonathan Lethem and Jonathan Franzen, both. And I don't have the titles at hand, but there are quite a few of them. And I guess you could call them essays, but they're also humor pieces. David Sedaris, some of his books. Sometimes he's a little over the top. I think I'd prefer... Somehow that turned into pretend. I tend to prefer his earlier writing. David Sedaris, stories. Okay, another book. Battery indicator is already reading low, which disturbs me. This is a fresh pair of rechargeables, and last week my rechargeables lasted for several hours worth of recording. Anyway, I failed to write down the author's name, but a book called How to Live, A Life of Montaigne, which is about Montaigne's essays, and it would make a really good introduction to Montaigne's essays, which I have not read. They are intimidating. Translated from the French. I want to find a good edition. There is an edition coming out later this year from New York Review Books called Shakespeare's Montaigne, or words to that effect, which would be, they think, the translation of Montaigne that Shakespeare would have read, which may have inspired some of his writing. So I'm excited about that book. I want to read that translation. I think it's that translation updated a little bit for language, but otherwise not too radically different. Two novels, which I think are the first two in what will probably be a trilogy, but one never knows when there is money to be made. Lev Grossman, The Magicians and The Magician King. These are like a realistic Harry Potter story. A more realistic Harry Potter story. With an older group of kids, like freshman year in college, older. And more streetwise, like they're from Brooklyn, so they're old kids, in the sense that they are a little more worldly, and seem a little more sophisticated. And they're not that convincing as young as that age, but somewhat. But it's a great story. It's a much more the world building, the magical world, the entree into it, a magical school, a hidden magical school, is sort of much more convincing in the effect that it has on these kids' minds and social life, and the idea that there's this subculture, this almost a hidden species of humans that can do magic. They're really good. I really enjoyed them. And it plays into hints at some elements from the Harry Potter books. It also taps very deeply into the Narnia stories. So if you read Narnia and enjoyed them as a kid, I think you might get a lot out of The Magicians and The Magician King. This year I also read, over the course of the year, I think I read the whole series. I may have started last year, I don't remember. All 14, I think it's 14 now, of Jim Butcher's books. I probably started last year. All 14 of Jim Butcher's Dresden Files. Dresden Files novel series, urban fantasy about a modern day wizard living and practicing his trade in Chicago. And they're not all fantastic, but the standard that the books maintain is really quite good. It weakens them a little bit, like it weakens a lot of series if you read them rapidly, because the seams start to show. If you read them back to back, the similarities sometimes in the plotting becomes a little overwhelmingly flashing red neon, like template and, you know, outline, slightly modified particulars from the last three books or whatever. So if you're going to read them, I would take your time and not rush through them, intersperse other books, like, which I did, but I still think read them too close together. Cold Days, the last one, is very good, but it wouldn't make total sense to jump directly to that one. So Changes is very good. So they're a White Knight. They're dark and somewhat creepy. There's also a book of stories that I've gotten through. His stories aren't scintillating. They're not quite as engaging. Not quite sure what's missing. A lot of writers, like, their novels are good, but if you read their short stories, they're like gems. They're like distilled essences of their writing. Butchers are good, but they're not stellar, in this collection at least. I'm not sure. I think he just needs more practice to really hone them. So anyway, it's an excellent series. They're not as memorable. They're not as literary as Lev Grossman's books, but they're really fun. The writing's excellent. It moves along. The plotting's good. The characters are engaging. There's probably never going to be a Library of America edition. They're just a little too formulaic, but excellent genre writing if you're into, or at least into, the idea of this urban fantasy genre. There it is. That's a a good example. Okay, same genre, Kat Richardson, K-A-T, Richardson. The last one I read was Downpour. I'm supposed to be reading The Sea Witch next, but that's the one I can't find. I became interested in Kat Richardson after reading a short story in the anthology called Mean Streets, along with Jim Butcher. The anthology is really good. Simon Green's story in there is the weakest, which is a shame, because he's usually a fun author, but the formula for the Nightside books, he's done with that series, and I'm kind of glad he's done. I think it overstayed its welcome, but it was good to have some plot lines wrapped up, but it was not very, very compelling towards the end. The story in there by Kat Richardson, which is just a luminously beautiful, wonderful short story. Creepy, supernatural story. And she did a fantastic job with it. It was just polished and polished and just really flowed nicely. Her books have gotten weaker. So the series, I'd say, start the series, it's a good series. Poltergeist is really good. I enjoyed it a lot. Underground is pretty good. I didn't write down all the names, but there's a two-part story arc where she goes to London, and it's starting to get a little tedious. And then this last one, I think it's Labyrinth, it's one of them. And this last one, Downpour, I didn't think was very good. And I apologize, Kat Richardson, but I may have mentioned this in a different podcast, not in this series, but you're going on for pages and pages about a stupid ferret. You've lost your way. Just had a feeling of indifference. It wasn't tightly edited. It didn't build up a good... I never did really quite figure out what the whole plot was about for this one. It just seemed kind of indifferently done, like she's clearly just cranking them out. And I hope the next one is better. I hope she gets some mojo back. But, not totally hopeful. There's a new one called Possession, and I have that one too, waiting to read. And its defining characteristic is that the cover art, the picture of the heroine on the cover art is terrible. My God. They're all like painted over photographs of an actress or a model. They follow kind of a series, and you can imagine that this woman on the cover is the heroine of the story, but the current one, she you'll just have to find it and look at it. I've been reading slowly at a series of books by Len Deighton. I was turned on to Len Deighton by Charlie Stross in one of the afterwords to his Laundry Files novels. Len Deighton is most famous for his spy novels. The Secret Files books, there's four. The Ipcress Files, Horse Underwater, Funeral in Berlin, and this one is called Billion Dollar Brain. And I love these. I don't feel like I fully plugged into the Cold War plotting of the 1960s, but he's a great writer. The dialogue with his anonymous main character and the descriptive language as he describes these very very gritty settings, bureaucratic settings, office settings, and it's just beautifully done. His writing is fantastic, and it's stuff moves along. It's occasionally horrific and dark and bloody, violent, but the way he evokes all this stuff, it's just terrific. Very, very dry humor. Very, very dry British humor. And his main character does not make spying sound appealing. It's sort of like an antidote to James Bond, at least to the movies. The books are less this way, but he spends... I'm trying to check out my battery life. Still going. He spends half his time worrying about his expense reports and paperwork that he's got to get done. And it doesn't sound that glamorous, and I'm sure it wasn't. It was a job, a dangerous job in many cases, a very dangerous job, for which you would not be remembered, heralded, or very heavily rewarded. But there's a lot of booze involved, and some women, and I think these things were maybe a little bit of consolation for the nature of the work. I had heard Drift Glass in the Professional Left podcast talk about this book, and I was going to buy it. I had it in my list, and then I realized that I already had it. Frederick Pohl and C.M. Kornbluth, The Space Merchants. This is a science fiction novel from the 40s. I had it in an anthology from the Library of America. I have the first volume of a two-part collection of 9 classic science fiction novels from the 40s and 50s, I think they are. So I started reading it. I had actually been in communication with Mr. Driftglass, suggesting that he and I do a separate podcast where we talk about science fiction, where we get together on Skype and I pick his brain about science fiction and we talk about that and its relevance today. And he thought it was a good idea. He said it was a good idea. I didn't know if he could find time, but I got busy and he didn't follow up very easily or readily. So I was kind of disappointed with that, but I was trying to get something going. But he's now doing a little segment on his show called Science Fiction University, where he answers questions, which I guess is almost as good as doing a podcast with me. Anyway, so he had mentioned this book. I haven't read that much Frederick Pohl, or at least not for a long, long time, and so I should probably get back into some of it. I want to reread some of these novels I read as a kid, like Beyond the Blue Event Horizon. And I don't remember them. They probably didn't make a lot of sense to me when I was 12. They probably make more sense now. Cage Baker. I finished all of Cage Baker's company books, with the exception of the last one, which I think was finished with the assistance of her sister, and I think the reviews suggest that it's not up to snuff. Cage Baker died tragically young of cancer. She was writing this great series of books and stories set in the company universe, and it's really good stuff. It's really compelling. I would say that the second book, Sky Coyote, is one of the best fantasy science fiction novels of recent years. they turned into the series turned into something that I wasn't totally comfortable with, and I guess she was, and it's her series, so there it is. But which is to turn a series of time travel novels into more of a time-spanning romance series. So you might even call it science fiction romance, which is not bad, but I'm not so into the sentimental nature of these stories. She manages to avoid almost every kind of tear-jerking aspect of the storylines and keeps it light and keeps it funny. But I found myself like, why am I reading a romance novel? I find myself saying and thinking that pretty frequently. Well, you know, it's a genre-bending novel is what it is, you know. And I'm always, in general, I tend to appreciate writers who do that when it works. And they mostly work really well. Although, I was getting a little tired of the conceit and kind of glad that she wrapped up the major story arc. But makes me wonder why there was another book. It's time travel, I guess you can go back and explore a previous timeline. I think that's what the last one was doing. Cage Baker, K-A-G-E Baker, kind of like Kat Richardson. Ian M. Banks. Ian M. Banks was actually two writers. Ian Banks, who wrote literary novels, and Ian M. Banks, who wrote science fiction novels. And you may have heard me talk about him before, but the ones I'm interested in most are the culture novels. And the last one I read was, sadly, his second to last novel, because he died recently in 2013. I'm very privileged to have managed to acquire a number of signed hardcover first editions of the culture novels. Not all. Sadly, it would have been nice if I had planned in advance. I've been buying them way earlier. Some of them never really did have a big hardcover publication, so their first edition, the hardcover edition, is really scarce, hard to find, or nearly non-existent, or was published at collector prices to begin with, and now has only gone up, and so I probably won't be acquiring them. But Hydrogen Sonata was the last culture novel, and you can look up Ian M. Banks Culture. There's a Wikipedia article about it. It's a really fun, fascinating world, kind of a big, sloppy science fiction world. Allows contradictory ideas in here and there, and somehow all still works. And the storylines are mostly really good and really fun, occasionally hilarious. The Player of Games would be an excellent place to start if you want to explore that series. The last one was unfortunately not the best culture novel, but it was pretty good. As for the best, I guess fans would argue about that. But I would say The Player of Games is one of the best. These are books that you can reread. So, Hydrogen Sonata. Nonfiction. Paul Midler. Poorly Made in China. I read that recently. I took it with me to the hospital when Grace was going down to give birth. It's a quick read. It's sort of a business book, but it contains anecdotes about what it was like to try and do business with a Chinese manufacturer, to transfer your manufacturing overseas. The guy that wrote it is this kind of broker. This is his work. What he does is to work with Chinese manufacturers to try and interface with American companies that want to outsource their manufacturing. It's a weird story. It really focuses on one product line of basically shampoos and body wash kind of products. But I think the lessons in it are applicable to just about any Chinese-made goods, which is everything in American stores now. Just about everything, almost everything. And I've seen this, so it clicks with what I've observed over the years, where if you buy a product, you keep it for a couple of years, it breaks, you go buy the same model to replace it. And I've done this a few times with different things. The new one, it works, but it's cheaper, it's flimsier. I did this with a Plantronics cordless phone headset. If you compare them directly in your hands, the new one is flimsier, the battery life is worse, the case is worse, the buttons are cheaper and cheesier. Everything about it is flimsier. They were both made in China, a couple of years apart. This is called quality fade, and apparently, basically every Chinese manufacturer does this constantly, trying to knock down their quality to save a few cents in margin. And it's a struggle for American firms to keep vigilant. My Fiskars Real Mower is an example of quality fade with Chinese manufacturing. I think probably all bikes that one would buy are an example of quality fade now. And he talks a lot about maybe the cultural reasons and economic reasons why this goes on. One of the things, he suggests a couple of very interesting ideas. One is that these companies really aren't making money. They're basically taking on these American manufacturing jobs as a loss leader, and they're not even making money. They're not even breaking even on them. But what they are succeeding in doing is cloning American designs, American intellectual property, American product designs, American ingredient lists and packaging and everything like that, so that they can create knockoff products that they then sell in the second world. I don't know if it's still called that, but in countries like Brazil, these big markets, especially in the southern hemisphere, the Indian subcontinent and South America, for more. Which should blow your mind that these markets, these second world markets, pay more for their products than American importers like Walmart. And they get what they pay for. But therefore there's an incentive to manufacture American products as a loss leader so that they can be cloned and create knockoffs for which they actually earn a profit to sell to the second world. He throws out, without a whole lot of documentation, but an intriguing suggestion at the end of the book, which is just as the Chinese authorities, the Chinese manufacturers, have this sense of pride to the point of lying about manufacturing capabilities and misleading and lying about everything that seems culturally strange to American businesses, that one of the things that the Chinese have lied about, the Chinese officials, is their population. That in fact, government statistics on the Chinese population may be a brag to a significant extent, like the Chinese population may be 30% less than So why would you brag about that? Well, because it's one of the things they feel they're competing with the world in, is the number of people. That's a bizarre thought. If true, it's a pretty fascinating thought. And it would suggest that and certainly China is still an enormously populous country. There's no getting around that. But let's say it was 20% less than claimed. That would still be a pretty big bombshell. Okay, I'm almost done, running out of time. Morning. I've only really covered the face of one card, so I'm gonna have to actually just stop. But, no, that's not true. I've got two pages here. I'm gonna run through really quickly. I've been reading a series called the New York Review Books Classics. It's put out by the organization that publishes the New York Review of Books. And this series is fantastic. Everything I've read from it has been fascinating, and I've been trying to acquire books from this series. If I had endless funds, I would just order the whole series. It's about 250 books now, something like that. And they're publishing, I think it's a couple a month, at least one a month. You can subscribe to it, actually. Like I subscribe to the Library of America, you can subscribe to it. Books that I've read from the series: Camerlé, The Radiance of the King, which is kind of a fascinating, odd novel about an allegory of colonialism in Africa. She's a French Ghanaian writer. Baron Corso, Hadrian the Seventh, a novel by an English eccentric lunatic about what would happen if one day he himself, the narrator thinly disguised as the author, was chosen to be Pope. Edward Williams, a novel called Stoner. Beautiful, beautiful short novel about the ordinary life of an English professor. Jan Morris, HAV, is on my list to read. Some other books: Ted Chiang, Stories of Your Life and Others. Haven't finished it yet. Great stories. He's a great writer. David Byrne, How Music Works. I kind of got bogged down in it. It's not maybe quite as interesting as... It's like David Byrne is very interesting on the surface, including much of his music. It sounds more like the first listening or first reading, it gives the impression of being more informed and more something than it really is, like having more substance. So I don't think I'll be taking away any major life lessons from How Music Works, but it's thought-provoking. It's a neat book. I like additions. Additions put out by Valencia, 828. That's probably not the name of the publisher. Dave Eggers Company. Dave Eggers Publishing Company. Okay. Jeff Dyer, G-E-O-F-F Dyer, Zona, which is a book, a long essay on Tarkovsky's movie Stalker, adapted from the Strugatsky Brothers' Roadside Picnic, classic Soviet era science fiction novel, really fascinating book. I have yet to see the movie. It's just the kind of movie that I tend to love. And I do love Tarkovsky's Solaris. Many people hate it. Okay, that actually is everything I've got on the cards. And that is everything that I have time for. I would be curious to hear from you, dear reader, what you have read in the last year and what you're planning to read. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye. So I'm following on with a little story to slip into this, the end of this podcast. Last night I had been basically doing chores for a good portion of the day, and I finally got up to the office to upload some photos from the baptism and posted them on Facebook and stuff like that. And of course, as soon as I left, I was not really finished, but I had people, Grace was calling me and said she needed my help. I was kind of put out at being interrupted, trying to finish something because I hadn't gotten much time to myself. But went downstairs and then, of course, immediately felt guilty that I had been slow to come on, to come down, or thought she was being overly demanding, because there was a bit of a crisis. The kids yesterday, the previous day, Saturday, had managed to break a framed picture, and the glass was still in the frame, and we had put up to deal with later, and Pippin had gotten it and tried to pull it apart and wound up gashing his finger open. And Grace was trying to decide if she needed to take him to the ER, because it was not, she couldn't get it to stop bleeding. I was putting out a surprising amount of blood. So, but with me holding him still and doing a little cleanup and whatnot, we were able to determine that it was not a big wound, and that apparently I would have taken him to get stitches if it had looked like there was something that should be stitched up, like a long gash that needed to be sewn shut. But it looked instead like a divot, like he had kind of carved out, like dug out a hunk of flesh with a point of a sharp piece of glass. We were also wanting to get a close look at it to see if there might still be glass in the wound. So we're holding his arm way up above his head, trying to, you know, keep the blood from flowing long enough to get a close look at it. It was not that big, but it was just a kind of a deep, like a divot chunk he took out of his finger. And she was using a damp cloth to try and stop the bleeding, and I think that was not helping because it was preventing it from clotting. So I finally wound up just pulling apart a cotton ball and wrapping that tightly around his finger and just holding it, and that actually staunched the bleeding pretty quickly. But we were a little concerned that he had bled so much, but we decided not to take him to the ER, but just to wrap it up with a couple of Band-Aids tightly and keep an eye on it and make sure it stopped bleeding. It did. But I'm not quite sure how I'm going to deal with it when I need to change the bandage, which probably would be, I probably should do soon, because it has cotton stuck to it, and I kind of like wind up trying to pull that off, it's going to start bleeding again, I think. I'll probably pull the scab off. So, I don't know. I didn't want to traumatize him unnecessarily. And if he doesn't need stitches, an ER is not necessarily a great place for him, because they'll scrub it out. You know, I know what they'll do. They'll scrub it out with this betadine or something. This red, you know, iodine-based cleanser, and, you know, tape it up or whatnot. But it seemed like that would just traumatize him more. And there's a very strong risk these days of picking up an infection from an ER that you wouldn't necessarily have in the wound itself. So I don't know. I hope we did the right thing. But today we'll try and clean it out and get it wrapped up again and hope that and see if we can get a closer look at what's going on. But this is just, there's just never a dull moment, you know, parenting a gaggle of young children. And I've got to be more patient because, you know, I'm thinking I'm being put upon. I don't get a moment to myself, and I finally do get a moment to myself, and then people are making demands on me. And it's like, no, she actually needed my help to make sure that our little boy wasn't bleeding, losing too much blood. But we fed him some vitamin C drinks and wrapped up his finger, and it did stop bleeding. And blood often looks like a lot more than it is. So it wasn't actually like puddling anywhere, but it was all over a towel and dripped on the table and the floor, and it's kind of a mess. Anyway, never a dull moment. I'm on the recorder again because I would be in a conference call, but once again our morning conference call was canceled, so I'm sitting here dressed up and no place to go. I have some code to get into, but I'm procrastinating, and I'm hungry. I need to eat some breakfast. Anyway, we also did this shift. I guess we're back on daylight savings time, and my system is very confused because it actually was light when I was waking up the kids instead of starting to get light just as I was walking them to school. So that's good. It should make it easier to get them up in the morning, but it also means that it's going to get dark shockingly early in the evening. Yeah, and my system's all out of whack. Take care, all. Bye-bye.